So, well, first of all, I want to thank you, Fred Eckert, that is, for agreeing to participate in this UN Oral History. I also want to thank you for all that you have done to make this particular segment of the Oral History possible as a result of the spokesman reunion that you organized. I would like to start off by asking you, what is the background, as you see it, of your selection by Kofi Annan to be his and the UN's spokesperson?
He really didn't want me initially. At least he wanted a woman, and I think he wanted someone a little bit more senior to me. I was a recent promotee to the P5 level. This was a D2 job, and I thought he probably felt I'd make a good deputy for someone. But he asked around. In fact, Mark Malik Brown was one of the people he asked to submit names. Mark was with the World Bank at that time, and they didn't come up with anybody. So after a month of looking, he finally just said to me, well, you take the job. But I remembered when I moved into the spokesman's office, even while I was acting spokesman, there was something I felt was permanent about this. I took charge. I had been in the office as a number three or number four for many years. I had done principal spokesman's jobs abroad in Namibia for the Yugoslav peace talks in Geneva. I knew how I wanted to do it, and I just hit the ground running. Well, within the UN restraints, of course, or constraints, because it takes a year and a half to hire anybody, and basically everyone was gone but me. So I had to build up the size of the office over 2 years. But I felt that even though I wasn't his first choice, he knew me well. He had confidence in me. When, under Boutros Ghali, I had been asked to brief alongside the chief spokesman, Joe Sills, to brief on peacekeeping, and where Kofi Annan was my main source of information for the briefing every day. I did that, I don't remember for how long, but again, somehow the politics of the 38th floor intervened. I was told I would not brief anymore, and Kofi Annan wrote a letter to John Hughes, who was a media advisor to Boutros Ghali, in which he said that I was the best spokesman he had come across in 38 years in the UN system. So he had been very flattering to me. I think he held me in high regard, but I think as someone who probably headed the UN personnel system before in his life, he maybe questioned whether a P4, recent P5, could jump into a D2 position.
That's interesting. Many people have the impression that you actually worked in DPKO, handling the press for Kofi Annan at that point, but it's then you were in the spokesman office, but you did handle that segment of the briefing?
No, both are true. I had been trying to get a promotion for 10 years, but I loved my work. And in the UN system, you get a promotion by changing jobs, not by being good at a given job and staying in it. And I asked Kofi Annan if he had any positions open. In fact, I think I was told by Shashi Tharoor that Kofi Annan had a kind of information post that had recently been created because the General Assembly was getting too much of its news from the media, and particularly on peacekeeping. CNN was breaking the news on what was happening in Somalia and Bosnia well before anyone at the UN reported to delegations on these developments. So it was thought that the peacekeeping department should have a kind of information officer to answer the questions from delegations. And so that post was created. Someone was put in it for about a year. And for whatever reason, that person was moved out. There was a vacancy. It was a P5. And I jumped into it in the beginning of 1996, mm-hmm. not knowing that before the end of that year, my new boss, Kofi Annan, was going to become Secretary General.
I see. Did you, in that capacity or in your earlier associations with him, did you detect a particular knack of dealing with Kofi Annan? You obviously were successful. Is there some quality that appeals to him that you have?
I don't think he's difficult to work for. Let me say something a little bit different. I think most people find him very easy to work for. Though the people who get closest to him sometimes feel it's not abuse, but he allows himself to occasionally get impatient, to express direct displeasure with your work, to perhaps blame you unfairly for something you feel you weren't responsible for. And it's very few people. I believe Elizabeth Lindenmeyer, who was closer to him than almost anyone, felt this the most. And I remember one time we were on a trip after I had been working with him for 5 years or more. And he was very critical of me for something that I could not reasonably be held responsible for. And I turned to Elizabeth and she said, "You've just entered a very privileged class of people." But despite those few exceptions where I was led to believe it was a privilege to be criticized unfairly by Kofi Annan, I found that he was very easy to work for, very flexible, but on the other hand, I never felt that I got to know him really well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many people besides his wife know him really well.
As you mentioned, while he was the Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping, there were a number of peacekeeping operations that were notable failures, especially Rwanda, but also Somalia. In your experience, how did he deal with the press on this? How did he, in a sense, explain the situation, or did he try? Did he try, through you or others, to get through to the press some appreciation of the complexities of these operations?
Well, it really wasn't for him to explain. It was for Boutros Ghali and Boutros Ghali's spokesman to explain these missions, their failures. And Boutros Ghali did not want Kofi Annan to have a high media profile. So he would not let Kofi Annan brief the Security Council. And my sense that Kofi Annan was basically told to stay at his desk and do his job. He, to the extent he did deal with the media, he has a very likable trait that if you ask him a question, he answers that question. Maybe not as fully as you would like, but you always sense that he's trying to give you the information that you're asking for. he also, as a person, not just with journalists, but with everyone, remembers little details about you, the fact that you have two children, or maybe even your wife's name. And with journalists, he would add that personal touch so that journalists liked him. I think that probably when he went to Bosnia to hand over that mission to NATO, there he was in the field, there he had a lot of exposure to journalists without anyone breathing down his back. I was not with him in Bosnia during that time, but I sense that he got very good press then, and also impressed the key member states, and that was probably one of his tickets to the Secretary Generalship.
That's interesting, and it makes me skip ahead to a later question, because what I wanted to ask was whether he did have such opportunities to deal directly with the press, and whether the image that the press got of him changed from these earlier days when he was head of peacekeeping to later days, in particular later period in his secretary generalship.
Well, I think he evolved as a person as well. So when he was budget director or personnel director, he would have no particular media profile, and he he probably didn't work as hard at being controller, where someone told me his nickname was the remote controller, to head of peacekeeping, where he was challenged, really challenged, and where he rose to the challenge. He I'm kind of losing my thread here, but I think it's a different Kofi Annan, who was Secretary General. He works consistently, methodically. I meet him every morning when he comes to work, and he has bags of documents, big envelopes full of documents that he's gone through the night before. He takes homework home every night. So that's, I think, a new evolved Kofi Annan, who rose to the challenge that life gave him and that he was never expecting. And his press profile, I think, rose along with that. You heard at the spokesman's reunion a journalist say that when Kofi Annan was elected Secretary General, he, the journalist, stopped by the office, and Kofi Annan invited him in and talked to him for half an hour. So he made himself accessible to the press. I asked him again during that transition period after his election and before he took office, how much time he would commit to the press. So I said, what's good press relations worth to you as a method of achieving your political objectives? 5%, 2%, how much of your time can I have to schedule press events? And wisely, he didn't give me a number, but he was rather good about saying, okay, I'll talk to the press regularly. I said, would you do a monthly press conference? Well, not monthly, but maybe every 2 months or so. Then he got in the habit of speaking to the press when he was coming into the building, so the casual press encounter became a regular feature for him. When he traveled, we said, okay, now as a rule of thumb, let's do one print interview, one electronic media interview, and one full-blown press conference at every stop. Every place where you spend 2 days or more, let's do at least that. And he accepted that and was doing that. Over the years, he's cut back on that. So the press conference turns into a press encounter with the foreign minister when he's traveling. And the two interviews get reduced to one and sometimes none. And the security element at headquarters has changed, because he used to walk in the front door every day, which gives the press the chance to intercept him. Now they bring him in the third basement, you know, among the loading trucks at this big loading platform, and he goes right into an elevator that takes him up to the 38th floor. So we have to arrange the press encounter to tell him, okay, now press are waiting for you at the front door. Will you talk to them? He says yes. We stop the elevator at the first floor. He gets out of the elevator and walks over to talk to them. But even with all of that, I think he has been more accessible to the press than his predecessors that I am familiar with, going back to Boltheim.
Right. And now this is a very general question, but from this fairly generous contact with the media, what image do you think they took away from that, and what have they at the present time? Has that changed? How do the reporters who, in fact, have had this opportunity, what image do they take away? Not just what they write, but what do they think?
What they think has been profoundly influenced by the oil for food scandal. I think that in the first term and part of the second term, they gave him the benefit of the doubt. I think they liked him as a person. They probably wished that they had more access to him than they did, but that's only natural. The reform agenda was hard for them to grasp, because it required a more sophisticated grasp of the bureaucracy than most of them had. But I think they were prepared to credit him with serious reform efforts. And on the political side, I think they sensed that his political instincts were sharp, his intentions were noble, and as a secretary general, he was up there in the top rung. Now, what happened with oil for food is that, for whatever reason, and I suspect it was ideological and political reasons, he was made a target. He was this very popular Secretary General with a nice, soft voice that average people found comforting, and whom average people felt was a nice, decent guy. And he headed a United Nations that in the 1990s, despite Somalia and despite Rwanda and despite Bosnia, was becoming more powerful and more central to the foreign policy planning of governments, particularly governments that were big political actors on the world stage. And then came Iraq. And Iraq, for a certain element of the political spectrum, Iraq was the expression of the new American power, an unchallenged, unrivaled power, that the United Nations should not in any way impede, and therefore to go to war in Iraq without the Security Council was part of the new order. And when he didn't agree with that, he was marked as a target. And when the invasion of Iraq turned into a nightmare, threatening that political end of the spectrum that said this is going to be the ticket to the American century, they needed to lash out somewhere, and they, in my view, they lashed out at him as a way of undermining the organization. But it has so, he has been so hammered by these attacks that even fair-minded people have questions in their hearts about whether he indeed is honest and decent, that somehow he may have known about this oil for food contract to the Cotecna company, that maybe his son's connection with that company wasn't as innocent as we first said it was, that maybe his long-standing, not friendship, but acquaintance with the founder of the Cotecna company actually came into play. It's hard even in these days when one single ex-FBI investigator working for Paul Volcker breaks ranks with Volcker, says that Volcker and Goldstone and Piet all went too easy on Kofi Annan, that in fact he knew more about Cotecna than anyone said. That FBI agent has more credibility than Volcker and Goldstone and Piet. A CNN researcher, producer actually, for a very pro-UN news program called Diplomatic License, came into my office yesterday, and I said, you really don't believe that this guy, this FBI guy, has more credibility than Volcker, do you? And she said, well, so the damage, I think, to Kofi Annan's reputation is maybe irreparable, at least over the short term, and only when the historians start writing about this 10-year period, if it does turn out to be a 10-year period, way down the line, there might be then some course correction.
This leads to several of my questions, but let me do one first. That, in a sense, I think you've already answered. But that is, the oil for food program has turned out to be a public relations disaster, undeservedly in many ways. But do you, as spokesman, feel that it could have been handled in some other way, and that part of this could have been avoided?
I think in the United Nations, we've always had the luxury of not having to worry about public relations. Basically, we were an organization of governments, and if we had government support, we could do our job, and we didn't have to worry about much else. And governments took care of the public relations. If they supported the United Nations or their particular policies in the United Nations, they would make sure that their public knew what they were doing and why they were doing it and why it was all worthwhile. If we have to do public relations for ourselves, we may in fact be in competition with governments. And they don't like that. In this case, if governments start attacking us, or even if it's just one government that attacks us, and we come out with a sophisticated line to attack back, as any politician would do, I don't think that's kind of consistent with our role. So we don't have the capacity. We may not even have the political latitude to defend ourselves against some of these attacks. Let me just stop there.
Okay. Because there's a follow-up question there. As you say, the Secretary General Kofi Annan obviously was shaken by the U.S. policy on Iraq and its attitude toward the Security Council. And shortly after that, he gave a major speech in which he said that the United Nations has come to a fork in the road, implying that things could go desperately wrong as far as the United Nations is concerned, unless it improved itself in some way. There are two questions on this. First, what do you think were the principal motivating factors in bringing him to this dramatic conclusion? And in addition to what, who? Was this his own perception, as far as you know, or were there influences being brought to bear on him on the 38th floor or elsewhere?
On the latter question, I think he is always influenced, guided by the thinking of others. He actively solicits the views of others as part of his decision-making process. He's not an academic the way Boutros Ghali was. He isn't a politician like Waldheim and some of the others were. He was an international civil servant who never expected to be in this job. The advantage to that is he knows how to pull the strings in the building to get things done, and he's smart enough to know that he needs to tap into the ideas of thinkers, policymakers, politicians to identify what needs to be done. He's also the first Secretary General to be formally trained as a manager. So with a master's degree from the Sloan School of Management at MIT, you kind of see that he organizes his tasks. He identifies objectives. He lays down the sequence of actions that need to be taken to reach those objectives. If he hits a brick wall and falls down, he picks himself up, redefines the new steps that need to be taken to reach those objectives, or adjust the objectives because they're not reachable, and he delegates down the line to get the full support of the people working for him. The first question was...
I've even forgotten myself, because I was interested in your answer just now. Let me go from there, though. You keep bringing up interesting points that bring me to other questions. And you talked about him as his managerial skills. Actually, a couple of weeks ago, I was at a breakfast for Madeleine Albright. And Madeleine Albright said publicly in this small group that she was really responsible for bringing Kofi Annan into the job of Secretary General, and that she loved Kofi Annan. She thought he was a wonderful man, but of course he was a miserable administrator. Now, the questions I have here is, you have been with Kofi for a long time. How did you see the beginning of this relationship with the Americans, and in particular with the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations? How did this come about?
Well, I think it's widely acknowledged that Madeleine Albright was one of the determining political actors that brought Kofi Annan into the Secretary General's job, but he had, as I mentioned earlier, already come to the attention of other governments and other Americans, including American military, in the job he did in Bosnia, and maybe even earlier the job he did on Iraq in releasing the international hostages, or if that's what you call them.
In the first Iraq War.
First Iraq War. So he had become a known entity, a comfortable presence, did not appear to be politically ambitious or threatening in that way, easygoing but able, and of course many people say that governments. That governments don't look for strong, dynamic political actors for Secretary General. They want someone who is going to do what they want him to do. I don't know enough about the politics in Washington to have a view on what forces came together to deliver this verdict. But I do know that on Boutros Ghali, the Americans felt that they had been trumped by the French. And I think on the next election for Secretary General, they weren't going to be caught sleeping at the wheel. They identified the candidate they wanted. They maneuvered to get him elected, and they succeeded. I was with Kofi Annan when he went to Washington for the first time, and it was extraordinary because it was like everyone was scripted to praise him. And that included in the Congress. And I believe that Madeleine Albright was already working with Jesse Helms to come up with some kind of a compromise on the funding issue. But President Clinton turned out at a reception and said all these warm, wonderful words. Kofi Annan then met with Jesse Helms, and Jesse Helms said to him, you know, I asked my staff to look into your background and try to find somebody who doesn't like you, and they couldn't find anybody that doesn't like you. Everybody likes you. I like you. And that was the beginning of a partnership, but it was all, I think, done by an agreed upon plan at the outset. I think Congress wanted to avoid the Article 51 loss of vote because the arrears were getting astronomical. They were looking for a political compromise. Helms wanted something from Madeleine Albright on the reorganization of the State Department. She was willing to make that concession. They cut a deal, and the Helms-Biden legislation went through, and the solution was found, and Kofi Annan got credit for having resolved that. Some of his advisors said, how can you go to Washington as your first trip? Because everyone is saying that you are America's man. Shouldn't you go to a third world country or some other member of the permanent five of the Security Council? His answer was, I'd go anywhere to solve a problem of $1 billion owed to me. And those weren't his exact words, but that was the thrust of what he said. And it made sense. Here was problem number one, U.S. arrears. And I think issue number one for any Secretary General is relations with the United States. You get that right first. On whether he was a good manager or not, Madeleine Albright, I think, was one of the worst managers, if you talk to anyone who worked in the State Department under her. So maybe it takes one to know one. But I think the criticism I've heard of Kofi Annan as a manager is Yes, he delegates, but maybe he delegates too much. He's intensely loyal, and maybe too loyal, so that he selects friends who are capable, but he keeps them on too long. So he kept Iqbal Reza too long, but he was so loyal to Iqbal Reza, he wouldn't let him go when Iqbal wanted to go, and Iqbal probably should have gone as chief of staff. So I don't know. I sense, as a manager, I have very good vibrations from how he runs the secretariat. It seems to me, by the book, that no secretary general ever had a cabinet. He created a cabinet. He holds regular meetings because he, not just because we're good at meetings here at the UN, but through meetings you share information. Boutros Ghali had three principal undersecretaries general on the 38th floor who managed everything. Kofi Annan eliminated those three jobs and let the heads of department deal directly to him, report directly to him, and then sit in on his weekly cabinet meeting where he could hear directly from him. Boutros Ghali would only let Mr. Garakhan brief the Security Council. Kofi Annan would let a D2 report to the Security Council if that D2 was the most knowledgeable person on the subject they were asking us for information on. So, I mean, it's just one thing after another that, to me, makes eminent good sense, seems like a perfectly logical way to better run a bureaucracy, these things that he's done. You can't believe that his predecessors never thought of these ideas. Has he been a brilliant success? No, I mean, he keeps trying. He put in results-based budgeting. Now, I was told that results-based budgeting was already so widely spread throughout the world that it wasn't a brilliant new idea. But he introduced it anyway, and he got governments to accept it. He's tried to revamp the personnel department, an impossible task, probably. I don't think he's succeeded there, but anyway, he's made one try and he's about to make another try. He knows how the bureaucracy works, and I think he continues to try to make it work better, and I would argue that he has succeeded more than any of his predecessors that I'm familiar with in adapting this place, also at a time in history when its role is changing. The end of the Cold War meant that the UN became operational to an extraordinary degree. It wasn't just a place where meetings were held. It was in 1993, the UN was the world's largest consumer of charter aircraft services. Why? Because we had peacekeeping missions in 17 places with some 75,000 people involved. The military had to be rotated every 6 months. You had to bring in food and equipment and all the rest. That took skill. We didn't have those skills at the time particularly, but we, over the last 10, 15 years, we've been evolving them. And he was, of course, as the head of peacekeeping, he was at the heart of where those that action was and where that new side of the UN was emerging. A terribly exciting time for the UN, and he was in the most exciting place. Did anyone criticize him for running peacekeeping badly? No, I think peacekeeping was run reasonably well under him, adapting all the time to these new challenges.
Right. There is another, still another side of this question, though, which is rather important, I think. I believe in the second segment of the Fulker report, he was criticized for inadequate administrative control. That was the main criticism, and only real criticism. This got played up in the press. So my question here is, has his profile, his public profile, become one now of an inadequate administrator, even if within the Secretariat the image is different?
Well, I'm not sure the even within the administration that he's recognized as a gifted administrator. So maybe it's just me who thinks that. The Volcker report, I think, so far is the elephant that gave birth to the mouse. They said that he should have followed up more rigorously on his son's connection to Cotecna, but his son lied about his connection to Cotecna. He has rather bravely said, yes, I accept your criticism. I could have done things better. If you were around in the 1990s, it wasn't the Secretariat that was in the driver's seat on the Oil for Food program. It was a wild, chaotic time. The Soviet Union didn't exist anymore. Every government was trying to redefine a foreign policy for itself in terms that made sense, and nobody knew what made sense. The Secretariat's role in Oil for Food was not particularly significant, and a much more significant finding by Volcker in the first report was that the Secretariat had managed the program competently, that the controller's work, the auditor's work was all done competently. Now, later on in the program, they felt that there should have been more auditors, and maybe that could have been done a little bit better, but that's a conclusion by Volcker that basically is ignored by everybody, and that reflects not on Kofi Annan so much as on Boutros Ghali, and really not on Boutros Ghali, but the international civil servants that have been around for decades doing the budget, doing the controller's work, and so on. It was done competently. I think the Secretariat, by and large, is made up of people who do their jobs reasonably well. Now, and what do you compare that with? The average government. How does the average civil servant's service of a national government, even a big one like the United States, how does that stack up? I think we compare reasonably well with the State Department or some other national bureaucracy here in the States.
Again, another question that really is in the administrative area. In all of your press briefings as spokesman, I haven't heard you give too much mention to the Deputy Secretary General, who supposedly is in charge of the whole area of coordination and, I suppose, the implementation of reform. Why is this? Why has no real effort been made to give a public profile to this new position, which in fact was created by Kofi Annan?
I think it's her personality. We were told that when her job was created, that we were to give her the same treatment we gave him. But they just don't compare. I mean, she was the classic vice president, the classic number two, working in the shadow of the boss, and we concentrated on the boss. She also, as an individual, didn't demand the limelight. She was happy to beaver away with the secondary portfolios, if you will. I sensed that she took an enormous load off his plate. That he's got his money's worth from her and from her office, but she never really evolved as the person who would stand in for him. We found that she would be traveling the same time as he was traveling, whereas we thought that she would organize her program to be around when he was away. But in fact, the chief of staff was the one who stood in for the Secretary General when the Secretary General was away. So she was at the other end of the top floor. She had her own little cluster of portfolios, which she beavered away at diligently and well, in my view. She did not demand a public profile. Even today, where we have perceived a political need to feed the press, and in Washington, our information center there is desperate to feed the Congress with nuts and bolts information on the process of reform. For example, she has evolved two new financial disclosure forms in the wake of these scandals about Maurice Strong's taking money from Tung Soon Park and so on. And we thought, gee, wouldn't it be great to say, hey, we're working on new forms. We have two in draft, a simplified one for people who do a dollar a year or when actually employed, and a more complex one for full-time staff. No, not a word. Didn't want a word breathed of it. It's her perception of her job is not conducive to publicity. We brought her to the briefing room a few times. We thought she did well. But, of course, in this oil for food time, the rabid critics among the press began to tear her apart the way they were tearing the Secretary General apart. She didn't like it, and she doesn't show much inclination to come back to the briefing room, the press briefing room, again soon.
Fred, I want to go back now to some of the nuts and bolts. When you did become the spokesman, when coffee and